That's Jimmy Smith with some of the best side men around, with The Sermon, the title track on his 1959 album, which had only three tunes. This one lasting 20 minutes and 12 seconds. Lee Morgan comes in later on trumpet, Lou Donaldson on alto sax, Tina Brooks on tenor, Kenny Burrell on guitar, and Art Blakey on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, January the 14th, 2015. And today I'm talking about media. We are talking about the media. And there seems to be an acceleration, if you will, about the media madness that we are experiencing. All the news that fits. It used to say all the news that's fit to print. Well, now it's all the news that fits, they think. Way too many media outlets are having a ball playing with our minds, providing a steady diet of coverage, as they call it, of major issues and events that don't tell us what we need to know, or that tell us what we don't need to know, or that simply make no sense at all. So we'll be taking a look at the media's role in shaping our minds and attitudes, because ultimately they shape our actions as well. And I'm hoping that in our first exercise of media literacy for the new year, we can take a look at how this phenomenon has expressed itself so emphatically at the beginning of the year. I want to take a couple of cases just to illustrate the point, but I want to come to the major story that is part of our focus as a nation, because the national media outlets are fixated on this particular story at the moment. But are they telling us what we need to know or what we ought to be considering? And that is, of course, the story in Paris in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks that claimed 17 lives over a three-day period, having to do with the publication by a magazine, a news magazine called Charlie Hebdo, that infuriated the Islamic community. And we have word today of confirmation by Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Yemen claiming responsibility for the Paris attack, saying that they planned it, they financed it, and they essentially shepherded this terror attack. Because the magazine, according to the Al-Qaeda branch in Yemen, was conducting an insult to Islam. Well, yes, I want to talk about this aspect of the story, because we are clear, and nobody should ever think that this is the right way to go, that you have a problem with something, therefore you conduct a mass execution of people in order to make your point. So I'll say for the minute that we will agree that this was terrorism. We will agree that this is not necessarily the best way at all to resolve a problem. We will agree also that this was meant to strike at the heart of the world, essentially. A small group making a dramatic and terroristic point that should it disagree, it is prepared to kill you. So we will accept these things as widely agreed upon things. We're not going to dispute this. Or if you do, you put forward your case. But I would imagine that we would tend to be in agreement with this. This is not the way that we consider ourselves as rational people. This is not the way to resolve an issue. On the other hand, what is it that the media are telling us? And more importantly, what is it that they're not discussing in this case? What really do you understand the issue to be here? We're told that the issue is about freedom of speech. That whether we agree with Charlie Hebdo, the magazine, whether we agree with its views or its take on things or not, that in fact, the magazine was operating well within the parameters of what we would discuss or we would accept as freedom of the press, as well within the what we will construe in the United States to be what we often cite as First Amendment protections. But is it as simple as that? And the media coverage has not departed from this specific line. There's no other way to see this as far, if you take a look at the body of coverage so far, this is the only way to interpret this reality. This catastrophe, this tragedy has only one way to be interpreted. And so it begs the question, what if you think differently? What if you think differently? The same French government and the world community of nations that is in solidarity with a publication that supposedly is exercising its right to free speech in a free republic and all of that stuff, that the propaganda that goes along with that. They are very much supportive of Charlie Hebdo, which, by the way, went on to print a new edition of more than 3 million and has sold out. People seeing this, in effect, as an act of defiance on one hand, and the flip side of that being a way of affirming their rights to continue to embrace and to operate as a press with its attendant freedoms, freedom of speech being the top one. But at the same time, since the event, France has arrested 54 people. For what? What is the charge? France has alleged that these 54 people defended and glorified terrorism. You see how puzzling this could be. And the media just covering this, this is what has happened. The French government has moved down on, just cracked down, I should say, on anyone seen as defending or glorifying terrorism. And one would say, well, wait a minute. Are they therefore not entitled to freedom of their own to express their views? Do we now have two entirely different applications of the so-called same law? That the government now is in the position of doing exactly what it objected to in this terroristic attack. He said that the terror attacks were attacks against freedom of speech. Here is the government of France openly conducting this crackdown on people it believes to be defending or glorifying terrorism. And one of the leading people in this category, as it turns out, is a comedian. Well, there's a lot of discussion as to whether he's a comedian or not. But he says he's a comedian and a satirist. Others call him anti-Semitic. Others call him hateful. And others call him highly objectionable. And he is one of those that they corralled. And so it happens, by the way, that this particular person, his name is Dieudonné, he is a popular person, but not in the positive sense. He apparently has been a thorn and widely seen in France as, for lack of a better term, a real pain in the butt. Offending people in the way that we've seen in the United States many so-called comedians offending people, and that's their shtick. That's his shtick. And so Mr. Dieudonné has been taken in and is now among a list of 54 people just corralled and being charged with promoting hate and promoting terrorism by the same French government that says it stands up for freedom of speech. So we have an interesting dichotomy here. He happens to be Mr. Dieudonné, I keep mispronouncing this man's name, Dieudonné, Mbala Mbala, who is the son of a French woman, and his father, I believe, is from Cameroon. But this is his thing. He has been an abrasive presence, and apparently his brand of humor is not entirely appreciated in France. That's one thing. The second thing is, the question has not arisen enough in the discussion, especially by the left, as to whether the so-called satire of Charlie Hebdo, the magazine, had crossed the line. Was it in fact racist? Was it in fact propagating hate? Was it in fact doing the exact opposite? Was it in fact causing a problem and in doing so, being very faithful to the historic white supremacist notions, the same colonial notions that it should have been attacking? This is a very important question, it seems to me, that ought to be raised. Because the notion here, and again, we're setting aside for the moment the tragedy of what has happened, because more than anybody else, the magazine has suffered the most terrible consequences. But it still requires an examination, it seems to me, of the central question, because now we're talking about a political philosophy here. What informs the magazine's view of the world? And is it, in fact, a progressive view? Or are we simply to take for granted the idea that they espoused left-of-center views, and therefore you give them a pass? Is it tacky to ask the question, well, have you had a chance to evaluate your philosophy, your political philosophy, that ended up as expressions, these cartoons that you do that are supposed to be satirical? Have you evaluated whether, in fact, there is some degree of merit to the argument that in so many ways, even though you are left of center or you profess to be left of center, you are in fact expressing the same colonialist mentality, the same white supremacist attitudes in your work? That's a very, very important question. But the media wouldn't ask it. And few outside the media will ask it. And I'm asking the question today. Why? Because we have this phenomenon all over the world. People on the left, people who would say they're very progressive, even leftist and radical and revolutionary, are nonetheless anchored in supremacist views that they believe should not be questioned. And further, that they believe they don't have. And yet you see very clearly that they too are holding to these same standards and won't let go, because there is safety in this place that they occupy of dominance. And in this regard, the left is no different from the right. They both agree they are entitled to rule. They both agree that their vision of the world is the only vision of the world. They both agree that they have the authority to define the reality for the rest of us. This is a permanent flaw in leftist movements around the world. The automatic assumption that as they see the world, so is it, so is the world. There can be no other version of the world, certainly no other version that matters enough to merit a re-examination of their role and of their actions. And media, of course, is a very, very, very important influencer of what we interpret to be our reality, and consequently, it is a very important influencer of our actions. based on our interpretation of reality. But we're not seeing this discussion. It has not surfaced yet. And it suggests to me that it automatically has been decided that there's nothing here to examine. Not on that front. All that matters here is that there are these people, very concerned and very zealous advocates for equality, and so that allows them to attack everybody. So they are democratic in that sense. They offend everybody. They take on everybody. But when you look at some of the caricatures, you cannot help but see stereotypical expressions, racist expressions, directed largely to populations of color. You just can't deny it. You see the evidence that this is exactly how they see the world. And in this regard, they're no different from the National Front, which is the rabid right of France. So they justify that, well, we should accept these things and not hold them to suspicion, even when it is so blatantly clear that the mentality that is informing these cartoons comes from the same space, the same history of the colonial mind. Now, that, it seems to me, is worthy of discussion. Because if we were to transplant it here in the United States, we have the same phenomenon. I've talked about it a lot. The left of center, many of the left of center movements in the United States actually have refused to conduct internal audits to find out to what degree they have been susceptible to the same racist mindset of the folks on the other side of the aisle. This notion that we can think, we can lead, we have the vision, we require everybody else to follow. And that is a central tenet of white supremacy. So, all these other things we are clear about, and I think we will agree, as I said, that this is a horrific thing to have happened. There's no excuse for it. There's no explanation that suffices for it. I think we would generally agree on that. But let's move the conversation a little deeper and ask the question here about the essence of the philosophy that informed the work of this magazine. And is it free and clear, as the records indicate, is it free and clear of the same contradictions that it says it is tackling? And to what degree did these contradictions play into what eventually occurred? The world is thinking very differently. And France, coming out of, a major colonial power. You can't help if you were born and raised in France with the notion of what is French and what is not French, who is French and who is not French. Even when you're radical, you always have to be on point as to whether you are also colonial in your mentality. Big question. And how does it apply here in the United States? And do we see any effort at all by the left, the so-called left, to tackle the question head on? You look at the staff, you see what it's uniformly white in a country that is very heavily immigrant from the Francophone African countries. You see that the thinking is exactly as we see it in the United States, in the progressive and radical communities even. Let us do, no, not let us, we shall do the thinking. We shall provide the intellectual food here for the movement. We just need you to do the heavy lifting. And we are beyond reproach. We are beyond this business of examining for contradictions. I go to my experience at a certain radio station where this was the pervasive thinking. And much of the internal problems had to do with the fact that for the first time in a more pervasive way than it had been in years, people of color were in positions of authority. And it was not to be tolerated. And so all kinds of machinations, you know, took place to basically remove that element, because in a very racist way, of course, they would never own up to it, but that's what it was. We can't have an entire network essentially operating under the authority of people of color. And if they are to be people of color, they should be our people of color that we could control, just like the regular racist society. And if they cannot be controlled, they have to be destroyed. See? And if this system cannot be controlled by us, we would prefer it to die rather than continue on a progressive path under the leadership of people of color. This is par for the course in the so-called progressive and radical even world. So we have to talk about that. Your thoughts at 888-874-4888. Have you noticed the reluctance? In fact, it hasn't happened yet. I haven't seen on major media this discussion. It's not readily available, and I wonder why. But it is necessary to take a look at, because especially in France, when we realize that the vast majority of people who speak French, the Francophone community is way larger than France, than the population of France. And it is predominantly African. And yet we have this oasis, this intellectual oasis, retaining almost all of the same attributes of the colonial days. The thinking, the driving forces, being completely free or almost completely free of input from the people who dominate in the Francophone nations, who are right there in France. We even have, for example, the companion of the editor who was killed coming forward to say that the family does not wish her to participate in the funeral because she is not French. So these attitudes are deep-seated, and it is time for us to begin to understand this is a major flaw in movements across the world. They can't get through, they can't get past this business of racism. They just can't get past it. A paternalistic view about how to basically direct popular movements, minus the input of the masses of people who are intellectually prepared, who certainly are very capable of leadership, but who are not at all permitted within the tight circle of decision making. What are your thoughts? 888-874-4888. We'll come to them right after this short break. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and your calls at 888-874-4888. We're talking about the way the media are astutely avoiding a very specific and relevant angle in the story that we have been talking about, and that is the terror attacks in Paris. From Maryland, Patricia, you're on the air.
Eutrice Lead, thank you for your show.
Thank you for calling.
I had a media story that was personal to me. Willard Scott on Today's show, he was kind of told like he was too fat from Bryant Gumbel. And, you know, it kind of, that's why Bryant Gumbel got fired, because, you know, he wrote a note. And, you know, so then, you know, that's just, I was just calling about that.
Okay, but what are your thoughts about it?
What?
What are your thoughts about it?
Well, now we have Al Roker, and, you know, he's, you know, and, you know, Bryant Gumbel got fired, or he had to move on to a... So I guess it's just like, you know, if you're this way or that way, like Willard Scott being overweight or, you know, not trim or something... So I'm just thinking, like, maybe it's like you have to be a certain way to be on the media, or, you know, or like with the French, you know, you have to be, like you were saying, all white, or, you know, it just seems like you have to fit a certain way to be part of, you know, the Today Show or that Charlie Hebdo, you know. So I just, it just brought up. A memory of that.
Okay, thank you for your call. I appreciate you calling in. Is this your first time?
Yeah, I've called into the Gary Null show, but I listened to your show because of Michael Brown and the Ferguson thing. Yeah, that's when I first started listening to your show.
Well, I'm glad that you called in, and I hope this would not be just your first time. I hope you would be calling in also in the future. Thank you so much, Patricia.
Okay, well, take care.
Thank you. From New York, Matt, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Good afternoon, all.
Good afternoon.
First of all, I want to take contest with this idea you're referring it to as terrorist attacks. Now, I know that there's a story behind Amy Goodman, and hopefully you might find a way to share that with us in terms of who had control initially of that program. But yesterday, because I do monitor the program, she had on a guest where they actually took on the whole idea of terrorism and terrorism experts. And she had a guest who wrote a book someone at Harvard who wrote a book, Disciplining Terror, and there's a subtitle I can't bring
but,
up.
But we're not discussing the program.
Well,
we're discussing
ideas. Well,
yeah,
because you refer to it as terrorism, terrorist mm-hmm. attacks. So what I'm saying is I've done some homework, and I'd like to refer everyone to another view about the whole thing, because basically none of it makes sense. I mean, you know, we're told that they found the suspects by an ID that they left in the getaway car. Now, first of all, these were military-trained special forces-type actors, and, you know, they wouldn't be carrying ID, and if they did, it would be somebody else to point it otherwise. So,
but they don't know that. You know, when people say these things with such certainty, you don't know what they would and would not do. And, I'm suggesting that the idea is just simply say what is reported. And without saying
right.
this is
okay.
not
okay, I
what they
what
would typically
saying, but
do. Just say this is
too,
what they reported.
The second police investigator in charge for the districts where they allegedly came from, and that's important to say, committed suicide on Wednesday after, you know, he sent people out and they would debrief. And the story didn't come out until Monday, 5 days later. So what I'm saying is there's so many anomalies that it doesn't add up. And I suggest everyone check out Guns and Butter. She had on the global research director, Michelle, I don't know if you're familiar with him, globalresearch.ca, his last name is something like Shudo Sokovsky. And the whole question was, you know, who was behind the Paris attacks? And point after point comes out that it's not what we're being shown through the media. It's far from that. On Kevin Barrett's site, Truth Jihad, this is somebody who's been a professor of Islamic and Arab and French studies, and he puts documentation that this is all orchestrated by the Zionists. And PaulCraigRoberts.com, he was with the Power Hour with Joyce Rowley on Monday. You can go to the GCN, Genesis Communications Network Live archives, and he was very balanced because he said, well, we really can't fully know what really happened, but he made point after point about what doesn't add up, and then he said, what we do know is there's a certain agenda to bring France back into the orbit of the U.S. where they actually, their lower house approved a Palestinian state. And, you know, their ventures in certain parts of Africa, the U.S.
If I could say this, all these things right now are conjecture. There's no proof of anything. We can, you know, there are people who are lining up things, and they fit always very neatly when you line them up, because these are theories. And it should be presented as such. These are theories. This is not proof. This is not certain.
Well, that was and, the point that I but, was just but, making by Paul Craig Roberts. When
I'm saying,
saying
though,
that you...
But, I understand you've cited several sources and several approaches to the question, but what I'm trying to say is no matter how many approaches are cited right now, we don't have anything that says conclusively this is what the case is. So until then, what we can simply say is this is what some people are saying. This is what they have said. But we should also be very clear and very responsible to note that these are theories at the moment. There's no conclusive proof about anything.
No, I'm not talking just about theories. I'm talking about the guy, the top police investigator who allegedly committed suicide on Wednesday. The mm-hmm. press didn't bring out the story until Monday. That's a fact. There's also a fact about this video. I found out earlier that the deputy editor of an Israeli publication did the video, because everyone was saying, well, was it, you know, closed circuit cameras or a cell phone? And, you know, there's no of a weapon like an AK-47, there was no muzzle flash. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you point blank shooting somebody in the head, it's like a pumpkin being broken up. So those are facts in terms of you have
those
a video.
Those are not facts. You know, remember, this on this very program, people had called in and said that there is no way that the beheadings of the hostages by ISIS was real. But of course
I question that.
You know,
that. The
but
point
the people
is,
had all kinds of explanations
but there wasn't enough blood.
One of the things
that you're missing is they use facts as to why they say certain things. Okay, now
but
one of the things
I understand all about.
That.
I get frustrated by the idea of any time we have a major event like this, that we have people neatly putting pieces together and then doing everything they can to make it work as
the proof. But everyone is not doing that. If you listen to or if you go to his site and see, he's
very valid. We will see. But it bothers me that we have people who are very expert at these things post facto, and yet if you examine what they say very closely, at best, you can say it is simply a theory at this point. It will take some time before we know definitively what happened there.
Let me just make this point. I'm talking about certain facts that don't add up. Let me just make this point.
But we must move on, because we do have a bunch of people calling.
Can I just say this last thing? All wars are bankers' wars. They control both sides. So basically, if you look into ISIS and what they're all about, how they got trucks with the keys in them and the instruction manuals, that's CIA. Al-Qaeda means database, a CIA term that deals with when Russia was in Afghanistan, they set up
I have to hold up here for a second. You're going back into the conspiracy theory. We don't have any proof of what you are saying. That's my point. You don't have any proof. It's an idea, but you have no proof to say this is definitively what it is.
But when they show you a video, right? You can see certain things that you say.
We can all see what we can see, but everything we are seeing right now, no one is in a position, you and me included, we are not in a position to say with any degree of certainty that this is the fact of it. It will take some time before we know.
Well, we'll
thank
go
you
to
for
those
calling.
Sites
Bruce?
And look at that information. And when Henry
thank
said,
you, thank you. We have to move on. Thank you. Bruce,
okay.
You're from New York. You're on the air. Hello? Bruce from New York is not there. All right. 888-874-4888. The thing is, I don't mind people saying that we have some ideas or we have some theories or there are people who are saying such and such. But, you know, I don't like it when people begin to say things as if they are fact. We don't have facts yet. Positive from Brooklyn, you're on the air. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
It's Positive, not Bruce.
Right, I know. I just said that.
Okay. I'm calling in regards to what you just saying to the sister in regards to theories not being facts. And I'm just wondering from you, at what point does a theory become a fact to you?
Well, when we can establish credibly the sources that document whatever it is people are saying.
Most theories are facts, rather, at one time were looked upon as a theory.
Well,
you know
we're going to get into an esoteric discussion. Here's the thing.
No, it's not that.
When somebody says, this is the CIA. Now, if I were to say, prove that to me, what is the proof?
Well, the sister was trying to explain to you about the proof that the person on the website was presenting.
Yes, but when people say that. Things like, this is the CIA who did this, and it is said as if it were fact. That doesn't make it fact, does it?
No.
So what?
I
am a reporter.
Okay.
And I tend to and an editor. And what
right.
I like is that every statement you make, there's attribution and credible attribution. So this dispels the whole thing about theorizing, because we could theorize ad nauseum, but it does not necessarily mean that we're any closer
with you,
to
but
the
at
facts.
At the same time, respectfully, we should also be doing is encouraging people like you do to think outside the box.
I agree.
And to think outside mainstream media views.
Correct.
And when you see people doing things like that, you don't discourage that.
I'm not discouraging. What I'm discouraging is the tendency to just simply arrogate, quote, that's the whole point of this discussion, to arrogate information as if they were fact.
And
to begin to question these things, but not simply to say, well, okay, this person is saying it's the CIA, therefore it is. That is not the way you think outside
you.
The box.
I understand what you're saying. I agree with you in that context. But like I said, I think it's just what you were saying on the caller before me was saying that the information that she was talking about was actually has the information, the source of information had proof on what they were saying. In other words, they were providing information or proof of the sources of the information they were presenting out, contrary to what mainstream was saying about the shooting. That's what she was saying.
Okay, but we have, for example, just to counter this, we have the Al-Qaeda in Yemen saying they're responsible. Why is that not credible? And the CIA is.
Well, even that, they saying that they are responsible for that could be questioned too. That's questionable, too.
There's a tape of them. There's the flag behind them and so forth. And they are saying they are responsible. They are the ones who planned it. They're the ones who financed it. They're the ones who organized it. And they're taking responsibility for it. So why is it that that's not nearly as credible as the idea that it is the CIA and the bankers?
Understood, but if you know, they did the same thing in regards to Bin Laden. They had the scene behind Bin Laden set up, and somebody saying that he was Bin Laden at the time, and saying he was responsible for 9/11, and that turned out not to be true, not to be even Bin Laden.
But I'm asking this specific question: why would we believe, or why is it preferable to believe it's the CIA and the bankers, and not the representative from Al Qaeda who said we did it? We claim responsibility for it. We planned it, we financed it, and we coordinated it.
Well, you're right, Latrice. And I think that what she was doing is more or less offering another point of view.
Well, this is my point. We can't play fast and loose with points of view. At some point, if you're presenting it as fact, we have to recognize that there's, there are theories and then there are facts.
Right.
Okay, that's all I'm saying.
Okay, we also have to agree that was secondhand information. It's not like the guy who she or the site that she cited. It wasn't the person. She was just telling you about the site. You'd have to go look at the site yourself and discern whether it was fact or just a theory, as you put it.
But thank you so much for your call today.
Thank you very
I hope
much. You
we'll call again soon. Thank you so much. From Brooklyn, Clarence, you're on the air.
The truth. How are you, my dear?
Fine, thank you.
Good. You speak very clear that a wayfaring man or woman may not be in error. You're saying, say nothing that is sounding like factual stuff when we don't know for sure. Just be said allegedly speaking or according to the press, like you said, according to the reported story. I always heard that the French people, still to this day, hate the Algerian people for daring to wrestle their freedom from France. And we should know by now, the Haitian people has never been forgiven, not only by France, but certainly by America, when they dared defeat Napoleon. It's one of the reasons why Haiti is such a vagabond nation today. It was forced, the freedom fighters was forced to pay 150,000 francs in gold, equivalent today as over $20 billion. And it was a blockade by France to make sure they got compensation for the loss of its slaves. And Thomas Jefferson, looking out on his plantation, seeing his slaves doing the same thing, he formed an embargo. So it wasn't Cuba that America had embargo against. It was Haiti. And Haiti has never recovered. So when you deal with the racism of France, America, and Canada, there's a reason to wonder why cholera is out of control in Haiti that no one wants to talk about in the mainstream media, because the Nepalese soldiers at their military base in Haiti, supposed to be peacekeeping soldiers, they had a broken pipe that was bringing the waste of human waste into the water where the Haitian people bathe, cook, and drink.
And all right, but how does this relate to what we're discussing today?
You're talking about the fact that the French people, France, and hatred of the racism, that they still don't want to deal with the racism that is still so far-fetched that they don't want to deal with people who are supposed to be progressive, don't want to deal with the racism that still permeates in the French society today.
Right.
Dealing with
Thank
their
you.
Hatred for the Algerian people and, of course, the Haitian people. And it's the hatred that people have been marginalized who are now living in exile in Paris, living in exile, living in segregated houses. They have no freedom of speech, no representation. There is no concern about having a high black official in the French administration. It's clear that the people who are former colonies in the that France had owned control has no say in the government. That's what I'm saying.
Thank you so much for your call. From New York, Bruce, you're back on the air. We lost you there for a minute.
I'm sorry. I'm glad you're dealing with the issue today about white liberals, you know, because even on this radio station, one day before you came on, between yourself and Gary, there's a lady who comes on, you know, for a minute or so, and she was heard to make the same type of derogatory comments about the black management at the other place, yeah? So I just wanted to mention this to as evidence of how endemic the issue that you are talking about today about white liberals and how they agree so much with the conservatives about the right to rule, about white people ruling black people. And that's a big issue. I mean, it's a big issue that goes back to, remember, Garvey and Du Bois. I mean, this has always been an issue. You know, even among black people, too, you know.
I'm talking about this because this is one of the aspects that, to me, is most profoundly missing from the discussion in what has happened in Paris. And this is instructive, I think, for progressive movements here in the United States. It's time also to visit this aspect of struggle. And it is a theme that I've raised a couple of times with respect to the Green Party and other parties and organizations that envision a kind of coalition effort, but not really living up to it in terms of how they operate themselves. And this is the discussion I'm hoping that this event can cause us to visit and to analyze.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. You know, I agree with you totally. But I don't think anybody wants to discuss this issue. I don't think there's any desire. Yeah? You know, black people on the one hand may feel they may offend people who may normally agree with them, and white people have their own take on it, I imagine, right? But I want to tell you that right in your own station right here, right, this same comment, derogatory comment about the management of the other place by black people was made on your very station one day, you know. And I thought it a bit, you know, it was a bit, you know, difficult for me to hear it, but it was made on this same station by people who are somebody who I would expect would be more understanding. Yeah. So the issue that you are talking about is profound, and we cannot move forward until we can try to resolve it in some way.
Thank you so much for your call, Bruce.
You're welcome.
That brings us to the end of our program today. And I'm hoping that this will continue as a discussion, because it stands in the way, it seems to me, of true coalition building and mutual respect in terms of where we are as disparate groups, perhaps, tackling different aspects of struggle. But still, we have to deal with these fundamental flaws. And these are impediments to progress, it seems to me. And I thank you for your input. It is always useful when we are talking. I've stressed the fact that we indulge in brave talk here. This is not a need to, this does not mean we put anybody down, but it means that we are mature in our consciousness and in our evolution, and therefore we can engage in these kinds of conversations without it having to be about, decrying anyone or debasing anyone. But we have to be brave enough to begin these conversations. I've been talking about that. So hopefully we'll come back to this again when we have a chance to see how the adjustments, if any, are being made in Paris, and whether it is actually transferable here in the United States within the progressive and left community. So thank you so much for joining me today. I hope this begins that kind of a question and hopefully a discussion around that will lead us somewhere positive. Keep it right here on PRN.FM, and you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Thanks so much for the pleasure and great privilege of your company. Bye-bye.